Sometimes, actually, particularly with, you know, business owners, investors, there's a focus on turnover being, well, you know, I'm a bigger company because I'm turning over 10 million. But actually, if you're, you know, if I'm a £2 million business and I'm making 50% profit and you're a £10 million business and you're making 10% profit, we're actually, you know, we've got the same level of money in the bank once we've done our work. So it's really sort of thinking about what sort of profit you're making within that strategic plan. And what, if you stop growing but your profit's increasing because you're doing things better, then actually you haven't really stopped growing. So it's being able to sort of have that mindset, and that's certainly something that I've learnt over the years, is not just looking at the growth as per the turnover only, but stopping and taking stock and looking at where the profit is.
Stay tuned to hear more of my conversation with Ronnie Savage. I'm Steve Hadley, and this is the Breaking Ground podcast.
Central Piling are proud to sponsor the Breaking Ground podcast. It aligns with our goals of providing technical expertise, continuous improvement, and community engagement. These are things we've been striving for since our inception over 40 years ago. Some of the engineering achievements during that time include the design and construction of the foundations for West London's tallest residential building, complex 3D finite element analysis to facilitate the creation of a triple story basement, and damage impact assessments for underground assets on a rotary cased piling contract. Our plant includes a wide range of bored piling machine sizes. These are continually being updated to ensure emission regulation compliance and efficiency. We're also able to offer driven precast and steel piling on selected contracts. To learn more about what we do and discover details of how we might be able to help you on your next foundation or retaining wall scheme, visit centralpiling.com.
Joining me today on the Breaking Ground podcast is one of the most recognisable names and faces in the UK geotechnical community. Ronnie, you're the owner and managing director of JOMAS. JOMAS are environmental and engineering investigation and assessments business, and it's great to have a fellow business owner and entrepreneur on the podcast and share really your journey into business and some of the challenges. We'll discuss some of the key issues facing the industry over the next three quarters of an hour. What I'd like to start off on is what really drove you to start JOMAS in the first place?
Gosh, I've got to think back 12 years. So I very much at the start was around a purpose and the way that I wanted to work in the construction space. So I'd gone from working with small to medium to working with a large engineering company. And what I wanted to do at the time was just combine all the great things I'd learned from small, medium and large, and sort of bringing that together into JOMAS and being able to offer the construction space just what I considered the benefits from sort of different sizes of companies.
Because you'd worked within site investigation businesses previously, and I saw on your LinkedIn profile.
I worked for a small company, Harrison Group, to start off with, medium size now, and then moved on to work for a civil engineering company, actually. So I only worked for a site investigation company at the start of my career. And then I went to work for a civil engineering company who then sold the company after about three years or so to Haider Consulting. So we moved over to Haider. And I worked with Haider for some time, and then I moved over to work for Parsons Brinckerhoff, who are now WSP, I believe. Lots of merging and names disappearing in our industry, but I think they're now WSP.
Yeah, that seems to happen quite a lot with consultancies, certainly at a global level, and it seems to be a real strategy for growth and market consolidation. I'm wondering, what resources did you have at the outset? And for example, when I took on Central Piling, there was already a business there. I don't think that was the case. There was just your skills and...
Correct.
Presumably not else.
Yeah, I mean, it was me, a chartered geologist, starting off on my own, really, from scratch, working with a number of drilling companies. But it was essentially me and my skills, really, starting off the company 12 years ago, yeah.
So obviously there's lots of sort of one and two man band drillers out there, cable percussion rigs The odd rotary cordery. So you had a directory of these businesses, and then you would go seek out some clients, say, I can do a site investigation for you, and presumably you're out in the field logging.
Correct.
Yeah. Correct. completing the report.
Yes.
The log.
Correct. I mean, I was
invoicing.
I was doing it all. I mean, I had some freelance support, like and drillers that I was working with, but I had essentially a couple of two main drilling companies who I was working with, who were doing the work on site, and I would go out on site with them, and I was logging and coming back and reporting with support from a couple of freelancers that I was working with at the start, but I was essentially starting off from looking for the work and making contact and doing all the sort of marketing and business development meetings to going out on site, meeting with the drillers and drilling team, and then analysing the data, writing the reports and doing it all from scratch to start to finish, and then invoicing at the end, which is, interesting times, actually.
Yeah, I think that those two ends of it are what really terrifies people, because you've got the technical know-how. So that bit in the middle where you're doing the report, that's your bread and butter anyway. It's making sure you've got the jobs. So new business, obviously no clients. There might be people that you've dealt with in the past, but essentially that the business has no relationships. So getting those in and then making sure you get some money for it and are able to pay those suppliers, because presumably lines of credit weren't available. So did you lean on old contacts? Did you just sort of say, no, I'm going to start afresh and just go direct marketing to people?
I mean, it was direct marketing. It was making contacts. Yes, I had some contacts of my own, but it was making new contacts as well. I did have a couple of my own contacts who I'd worked with for many years, probably throughout most of my career. But it was making those new contacts, but not having the fear factor. Actually, I think that knowing what I know now, if I was to go back 12 years, I probably would have been a lot more scared and fearful of what I was about to embark on, but actually going into it sort of with that sort of clear purpose in my mind made it a lot easier for me to just focus on that rather than all the other obstacles that I'd had to deal with, which I wasn't considering at the time.
Okay. So you just, in terms of managing cash flow, you just found a way of getting by. You sort of begged, borrowed to get through that.
Yeah, I mean, I put some money aside, so I had some money to pay the first few bills that came through. But most importantly, I kept it lean to start off with. So, started off on my kitchen table, for instance. So I didn't have huge amounts of costs to pay for. And I was fortunate, actually, at the start that I had clients who paid me on time, which then made sure that I was able to pay my suppliers. So I was quite fortunate, to be fair, when I started off with the sort of people I was working with. And the fact that I kept it lean to start off with.
Yeah, I think that's great advice, because at the outset, the costs are so low, people are going to struggle to compete with you. It's really hard once you've started giving out pay rises or the company gets big, to bring that back down in size. How can you retreat from that position? And it's really painful as a business, as an individual, to have those sorts of conversations. So I would say to any business owner, just keep it as lean as you can for as long as you can. I know we've all got growth ambitions, and we'll talk about growth in a moment, but really, you've got to be so careful as you expand, because it won't be a linear journey. There will be peaks and troughs, and can you manage that as a business in those early stages? If you take on a team of engineers and then all of a sudden you haven't got the work coming through.
Correct.
So you spoke about the vision. I mean, did you sit down, did you write a, like in that classic way, write a business plan? How did you do it? Or did you just sort of win the work, get paid for the work, or was it more strategic than that?
To be fair, I did have a business plan. It was only about 3 pages long, though. It wasn't certainly not as detailed as what my business growth plan is now. But I did have a business plan because I did, I had some advice around me just to make sure that my structure was right and that I knew exactly what I was aiming for in my first year and how I was going to pay for that and then sustain the business into a business that was able to grow. So I did have a business plan. I think it's extremely important that you have a plan, because otherwise you go in lots of different directions. But I think that's what sort of curtailed my costs in the first instance, was because I had a plan of the costs that I was able to incur in the first 6 months and thereafter. So, I mean, that's the most thing and most important thing, is to do a little bit of research and have that plan, at least for the first 6 to 12 months, and then review it as you progress.
Yeah, people talk about these SMART objectives, so specific, measurable, achievable, realistic, and time-bound. Mm-hmm. Time-bound. And I certainly found that quite useful when I was starting out in the business world. And I was astonished when it came to the projections and some of the key elements in terms of buying machines or identifying when we should take on a person in a certain role. It all seemed to fit together. It was astonishing. I've got to say, last few years, with all the other variables of the market, it's been more challenging to actually stick to that. And one thing I would say, in a tough market, I think we're all inclined, because ambition as business people is to say, right, we're going to carry on growing. Actually, that's not always realistic. And sometimes we have to counter our enthusiasm for growth by saying, well, this is what the reality is going to look like. It can be hard to lay that out. And if you've got other shareholders, get them to buy into a strategy which is essentially quite a stagnant business. But where do you see growth within Jomus and the, I suppose, the UK geotechnical sector over the next business cycle, over the next 10 years or so?
I mean, as a business, I mean, I see huge potential in brownfield land development and reclamation of brownfield sites and bringing them to good use. And that's something that we certainly want to focus on over the next stage of growth. I think going back to what you said on planning, it's important that there is a strategic plan, because there is sometimes, actually, particularly with business owners, investors, there's a focus on turnover being I'm a bigger company because I'm turning over 10 million. But actually, if I'm a £2 million business and I'm making 50% profit, and you're a £10 million business and you're making 10% profit, we're actually, we've got the same level of money in the bank once we've done our work. So it's really sort of thinking about what sort of profit you're making within that strategic plan. And if you stop growing, but your profit's increasing because you're doing things better, then actually you haven't really stopped growing. So it's being able to sort of have that mindset. And that's certainly something that I've learnt over the years, is not just looking at the growth as per the turnover only, but stopping and taking stock and looking at where the profit is as well.
Yeah, the turnover is great for the ego, isn't it, to think, oh, I'm running this big business, but really it doesn't pay the bills. And you do need to look at the bottom line.
Correct.
Particularly in the early stages, yes, you can probably cope with periods of growth if you're a bigger, more established business where you're not making a profit for a period of time, not indefinitely, but at the early stages, profit is, and managing your cash is absolutely key. Yeah, interesting you mentioned contamination there, clearly an area of expertise within your team. I wonder where the fight against CO2 emissions fitted in within your sector.
Yeah, I think what we've worked on doing for so many years, for instance, with land remediation, is considering sustainable remediation solutions. And over the last 10 years, we've tried to avoid digging and dumping as the sort of quick remediation solution. It's become possibly the most costly, but it's quicker. And what we find as an industry is that remains the go-to solution, because it is quicker. Because when you balance the time constraints, it becomes more costly to employ alternative strategies, which may seem to be cheaper on the bottom line. So as an industry, I think that's where The sort of R&D work is ongoing to look at those strategies which are quicker, which enable construction projects to commence, so we can avoid digging and dumping, which is essentially just taking the problem from one place and putting it in another. And we have advanced over the years, because certainly when I started my career, digging and dumping was the only solution. Well, it wasn't the only, but it was you know, the solution that everybody went for. But now there are a lot of other strategies around, and that's something that we would continue to look into as a company.
Yeah, I think I'm sorry, I always bring it back to pilot, but I'm thinking of a contaminated site, and although 90% of the bore might be inert, you've got this 10% of the spoil that might be hazardous, for instance, and with it all getting mixed up, then it all gets lumped into this hazardous waste pile, which clearly is very expensive. Actually, if there's ways to treat that on site, possibly that soil can be used for landscaping on the site, or it can be sent to a more local tip that can take the inert material. I think we need to be creative. There's obviously a financial benefit from having these solutions. So it's great that there's companies.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as an industry, we just need to work better together. It's the collaboration of different experts on these construction projects. So if we wrote a report and we found contamination on site, we'd always recommend segregation of that during piling, for instance. Is that really happening? Is that information being transferred on so that, you know, somebody's thinking about how do we segregate these materials? Can we segregate these materials so that the inert material doesn't get mixed up with the hazardous material? Is that possible as part of our whatever the operations are on site? I mean, that could be piling, it could be digging of shallow foundations, or other enabling works. It's just that sort of consideration of sustainability across, particularly in the groundworks side of things. It's something that needs a bit more work in our industry through collaboration, I believe.
Well, there's so many different directions I can take this conversation because you're involved in a multitude of things. And one of the things that occurs to me is, how can you possibly manage dealing with all those things? So as a business owner, as a mum, as you know, as a volunteer, how do you cope with the stress of all these responsibilities, Ronnie?
That's an interesting question, because I had a meeting with a mentee of mine this morning, and we had the same, like, you know, I was talking to her about staying calm, because it's something that I've worked on over a number of years. And I think because I'm juggling so much, and, you know, we work in construction, we know that there's constantly challenges thrown at you. You wake up each morning, you have no idea what challenges you're going to have to deal with that day. And my approach to dealing with those is calmly. It's solution finding. So if I spend a lot of time worrying about an issue, then I've wasted time that I could have spent finding a solution to that issue. So I suppose that keeps me calm in a way, because I'm in my mind just thinking, what is the solution? How do I resolve that? And once I've resolved it, I can move on to the next. That's how I deal with things. I've got a diary where everything I do is in my diary. But it's just a case of, I've got an issue, you know, stressing about it isn't going to resolve the issue. And if you have that sort of mindset, it doesn't mean that you don't deal with challenges and you don't, intrinsically worry about things, but it's more, my worrying is more focused on what is my solution, thinking about my solution rather than worrying over the problem that I'm having to deal with, if that makes sense. So that's, I suppose, what keeps me somewhat calm. Yeah.
I think that's great advice. And personally, what I try and do is have perspective over it. You know, there's so many people that are in more difficult situations than myself. So despite having all these multitudes of things, whether it be the sort of Federation Partner Specialist, the podcast that we've got here, you know, I just try and realise that actually there's a lot of people out there with a lot tougher times, and just try and look after myself as best as I can. One of your other roles, Ronnie, is with the Federation of Small Businesses. Could you tell us a little bit more about what you do there, and why it's a good organisation to be involved with?
So with the FSB, I'm a construction policy chair. That essentially means that I have the opportunity to be involved in policy relating to our construction sector, which affects SMEs. So I'm invited to have conversations with, for instance, I may have a conversation with the government around policy, but most importantly, I'm speaking to other small businesses and trying to understand what challenges they're facing and what the FSB can do in terms of discussing that, presenting that to the government. So that's quite interesting, actually. Again, it's more around identifying the issues that we face in the sector, but coming up with solutions for alleviating those issues.
And I know there's a multitude of them, but what would you say are the key issues facing our sector at the moment?
Where do I start? Poor payment policy, it's number one on my list. I think as an industry, we just have an industry that's where it's just notorious in terms of getting paid on time. I mean, there are a number of reasons for that. Sometimes it's an administrative error, which is fine. That's that does happen across all businesses, where maybe the invoice has gone to the wrong place or not been addressed correctly. That's not the issue I'm talking about. It's more where people use consultants and contractors as a bank, essentially instructing work that they've got no means of paying for. And then when they get into trouble, or they do that in the hope that everything goes according to plan for them, and as soon as it doesn't, then that consultant or contractor doesn't get paid. And I just think that that's very naughty that can happen, and they can then just move on and shut one company down and move on to the next. So that's certainly something that we're working really hard at FSB to tackle. And I know that the Small Business Commissioner is very much hot on poor payment. So that is one issue that's getting a lot of attention. Obviously, planning is another one within the construction sector in terms of the issues and inconsistencies around planning from one local authority to the next, and whether there's some work that can be done around reforming policies to ensure that there are consistencies across local authorities. I mean, I can talk about this. We only have 45 minutes, so we don't want to be talking about my FSB work, because it takes a lot of time.
One area that's sort of a natural extension of the challenges facing not just our industry but many industries is on recruitment at the moment. We know that people are struggling to find employees to fill their vacancies. And yet there are still people out there that can't find a job. So close to my home, in fact, in my home, my partner Jen's looking to get back to work after 4 years looking after our youngest and many other things besides. But she's struggling to find an opportunity that is a part-time opportunity because she doesn't want to go back to a full-time role, but still in a senior position. And there seems to be, this isn't an issue that's just restricted to construction, but there seems to be a lack of senior roles that are available on a part-time basis. And I wondered whether the FSB had any discussions around flexible working, and but particularly with a view to senior roles, because I think it's so important that we can find flexible positions for people in senior positions, because it demonstrates that businesses are willing to embrace it.
I mean, that's an interesting point you raise, because I'm, as a business, employing people now on a part-time basis for that specific reason that you just cited. I think it's not just a small business issue. It's a mindset across all businesses in understanding that, you know, you don't need somebody to be there for the full 40 hours for them to be fully productive. And there is a mindset shift which has been caused by Brexit and COVID and everything else that businesses are having to deal with, to realise actually if we're struggling with skill shortages, maybe you can have two people do that work who are working on a part-time basis. It's certainly something that I've considered around my business, and I've actually recruited into working. And I think other businesses will have to get on board and realise that is the future.
Yeah, well, you can get in some fantastic people. You know, if we open our minds to the possibilities, there are some amazing individuals out there that don't have the desire or the capacity to take on a full-time role that actually could probably offer an amazing amount of value to companies if people would just put out their adverts, job adverts, saying, yeah, we're open to flexible work and we're open to reduced hours solutions, working from home. And we are seeing a bit more working from home now, but probably not as much as there should be. So, yeah, I suppose just carry on fighting that cause within the FSB and your connections with government. The other side of recruitment, not the senior end, but at the junior end, is on with people within schools. You know, construction's traditionally had a problem recruiting women particularly, and I know you do a lot of work with girls in schools. Tell us a bit about your work on the schools outreach program and why that's important to you.
Sure. So, I mean, we work in a space, in the construction space, where 12 to 14% of the workforce is female. And we live in a country where half of the population is female and we're suffering skill shortages. And we're wondering, how do we plug this sort of skills gap? I mean, common sense solution to that is, let's tap into those who could potentially work in industry but aren't doing so at the moment. And that's not just women, that's diversity across all angles, and really thinking about that as not just a problem, but actually the solution to the problem that our industry is facing. So I know, for instance, when you look at just in terms of just women studying engineering at the moment, when you go into universities, on average, you've probably got 20% of students on most engineering courses being female. So it makes sense that we've only got 12 to 14% in industry, because you have people who come out of university and go and do different things. So to really sort of resolve that issue, what we need to do is make sure that we fix the problem at grassroots stage. So we need to attract more girls into those fields of study to start off with. So I take part in I'm involved in lots of different organisations, which enables me to go into schools, enables me to go into universities, to have conversations with them. And I think that an easy way for me to have those conversations is I tick a number of boxes. I'm able to go in there and say, I'm a woman who runs my own business and this is what I do, and this is what I've been able to achieve. I'm also a woman of colour who's been able to do this and this is what I've been able to achieve. And what that does then is it demonstrates what is possible. So I'm always encouraging people out there to be visible and to go into schools, because if we don't fix the pipeline, if we don't get more people in, if we don't fix that diversity from the grassroots, we're going to be fighting a battle at the top, which we're never going to be able to resolve. So that's why I do it.
Yeah, I think understandably people have felt like they don't fit in. And I hope you don't mind me bringing this up, but I know that when you started Jomus, you felt quite insecure about your ethnicity and about your gender, and hid away at times from revealing who you are, which isn't right. Do you want to explain to the listeners a little bit about that period in your life?
Steve, gosh, yeah, let's go there. So I mean, I ran Jomus with the name Ronnie Savage, you know, with no photographs on social media for so many years. And I suppose, yeah, I admit to the fact that yes, I suffered imposter syndrome, because when I looked ahead, you know, when I walked into the meetings, nobody in that room looked anything like me. So you suffer from imposter syndrome, because you think, you know, is the industry quite ready for somebody who looks like me, for somebody who's a woman who's black? So, you know, I'm confident enough in my competence and in what I have to offer. But then you have that drawback from how you may think that you're perceived. So, you know, I'm determined now, because I, for so many years, hid behind the computer and said, let the work I'm doing speak for itself. I'm determined now that, because I didn't see anybody who looked like me when I was building my business and building my career, that I want to be that person that people see, so that they're not held back for however many years that I was held back for, that they're able to look ahead and say, actually, Ronnie Savage has done it. So it means that there is an opportunity for me as well. I hate doing podcasts. I hate doing video calls and interviews and meetings and doing all of that. But actually, I know that I have to do it. I have to be visible so that there is an opportunity there for others to look ahead and not go through that sort of feeling as an imposter, because they're not an imposter anymore.
Let's talk about your time with Goldman Sachs, because as much as you mentor other people, and thank you for signing up to the Ground Forum undergraduate scheme to mentor a student, but we all need mentors in our life, and I think that's provided you with some assistance in the growth of Jomus as well, isn't it?
Yes. So Goldman Sachs, wow. I mean, that was a turning point for me. So I remember I'd grown the company to a certain level, and I was speaking to a business associate of mine. I was thinking, goodness me, I didn't think I'd be here. And I've never really had formal business training. I've just done all of this has been natural. And they recommended the Goldman Sachs program. And I went on the program. Even at this point, I didn't have photographs or anything on social media. And I went on the program and I learned so much about the sort of the financial aspect of my business, about the sort of leader that I was and should be and wanted to be. And just, it's just a, delved into who I was and what owning a business meant. And I just learned so much from that. But actually, two important things, aside from all the fantastic things that I learned, two important things for me was that was the first time that I was told, switch off your phone for a duration of time. And I think up until 2017, I'd ran my business with my phone sort of glued to my palm, and being told, you know, to switch the phone off essentially was quite tricky, but it helped me to learn about stepping back from the business and building a business that wasn't just about me, but also, you know, having that sort of management team around me and building the structure of the business so that it could run without me. So that was one key thing that I was forced to learn, actually, very, very quickly.
How many hours are we talking a day of turning it off?
I mean, I went into a residential. It was a full day, right? It was a number of days, actually, but it was that sort of full being sat in the room until you had a break and not being able to answer the phone. So, you know, it was that was tough. I've got to be honest. That was really, really tough for me, but I had to do it. And this is why I said I was forced, but I think it was the best thing I could have done. Secondly, in terms of what I've gained mostly from the program, was just the alumni, the friends that I've made, the fact that we're all on the same page. And, you know, we can have open and honest conversations around, you know, our challenges and the opportunities that we face as business owners, because we're all, irrespective of where you are on your business journey, we all have very sort of similar experiences that we can share. So alumni was great, but being able to step back, to step up is what they called it, was amazing as well. I mean, my analogy for the Goldman Sachs program was that, you know, I got into a plane, and midair, I was sort of standing there thinking, I'm not jumping. I don't have a parachute. I'm not jumping. And somebody just walks behind me and pushes me. And then I'm sort of floating there thinking, oh my goodness, I've got a parachute. This is amazing. This is great. Why didn't I do this years ago? And that's exactly what the Goldman's program was for me. It's just pushed me to do something I probably wouldn't have done, but I'm really pleased that I have.
So was it a similar to an MBA type program, was it, in terms of content?
It is, but it's condensed. It's just lots of learning in a short period of time. So I think they call it a mini MBA. I mean, you get to go off to various different universities. So I went into Oxford University and we had a bit of learning there. We went to Aspen University. You know, it's absolutely fantastic. I couldn't speak highly enough of that program.
And for people that are listening that might be interested in getting involved, was it a case that they approached you, they'd identified you as a potential leader, or you found out about the scheme and applied?
You find out, you apply. Somebody told me about it and I went on the website, and it might be daunting when you look at it in terms of the questions and the process that you have to go through, but honestly, it's been the most amazing thing ever. I mean, I've just had a meeting with the business minister this morning, and the government have also got a Help to Grow program, which is similar. But yeah, I mean, I've been on the Goldman Sachs program, and I wouldn't recommend anything as much as I do, honestly, in terms of business growth.
Wow. And how long does it last? So clearly it's a part-time course, but you do it over.
I mean, it's only not at all. It's only on for 3 months. This is why it's so.
Okay.
Yeah, it's quite intense. But it's on. But it's built around you as a business owner, so that you're working on the business, not necessarily in the business. So they're taking you out of that, but you're working on your business while also doing this. So it's spread over 3 months and everybody else is going through the same as you are. So
yeah, and clearly those networks that you form, they exist hopefully long after the course is completed.
I've made some friends. We're stuck with each other for life, so they're not going anywhere.
Well, that's fantastic to hear, and it was great to meet you personally, Ronnie, at the Ground Engineering Awards recently. And I think as we say come out of COVID, obviously with the latest variant, it's locking us down a little bit more again. But it's great to get out and meet a few more people from the industry over the last few months, and look forward to meeting you at another event in the near future.
That would be great when we can get back to normal again, and just it would just be fantastic. But I think that's some time away, unfortunately.
Yeah, looks like it now. But thank you for your time today and your business masterclass for our listeners.
Thank you, Steve. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. Just a reminder, the Breaking Ground LinkedIn group is now live, so please join me on there. Bye-bye.